Access number 28650, Mr. Gordon Mellor, rail 16. Now, we'll pick you up on, you're in your Halifax flying towards Aachen in Germany on the 5th of October 1942. And on the way, you've had a thunderstorm, and now you've got the Northern Lights, and you're in a very long, straight, direct approach. Not the normal slight deflection from the route. No. You're going straight to Aachen, very obviously so. Well, from the time you're over, you know.
Yeah, there must have been a change in the wind conditions. Because although on the chart we were heading direct for the target, as we approached from quite a distance, we could see that there were flares and signs of a raid going on over quite a wide area. As we got closer, it there seemed to be a line more or less north and south, where which was being attacked. Was five or six. In actual fact, I thought it was nothing else but a shambles. And certainly, where we approached one of the conflagrations, there was it wasn't Aachen. That was quite sure. So. Twiggy Hawthorne and I sort of put our heads together, so to speak, on the intercom and said, well, which way are we going to go? So we thought that the breeze, the wind had changed and blown us north. So we headed down and did a recce round there, all at about 13,000 feet. And he said, there it is. And so we found Aachen itself, and there wasn't much. Flak different from usual. Not a great place. I'm not really sure what the object of the raid was now, but certainly there was a few hundred aircraft milling up and down that area. So we attacked it, went in, dropped the bombs. I suppose we dropped them. Oh, I don't know, somewhere around about 10,000 feet. We wanted to get in and out as quickly as possible, so we went in a shallow dive. And I don't know whether I dropped them or whether Twiggy did. Some detail which escapes me entirely. Anyhow, we did. And the pilot swung us round towards the north to come away from the target and to head for home. Well, we hadn't got round very far. We were still virtually not very far from flak coming up. And the rear gunner said, there's a fighter behind us. And I rather fancy he said, he's beginning to formate on us. And he says, yeah, it's 400 or 500 yards away at the moment. And so we sort of went into a slight dive, I suppose, again trying to lose height and gain speed. But he kept up with us, and eventually the mid-upper or the rear gunner said, it's an ME-110. They recognised it as a twin engine aircraft. And we had a bit of a conflab. Well, he could sit out there at 500 yards and lob a cannon shell at us, and our 303s wouldn't worry him too much. So we didn't do much to start with, and then when he got a bit closer, then our gunners opened up on him, try and scare him off. But he was a bit more canny than that, because he sort of sank down so that the mid-upper gunners certainly couldn't get at him. And the rear gunner was not having much effect on him by the sounds of things. And he started to cannon fire. And, he hit us. He had three goes at us, one way or another. One of his attacks injured the rear gunner. And one has visions of these globes of light whizzing past. And Whether it was inside the aircraft or not, I don't know. I've got a feeling some of it was, which was very close. And certainly there was some on either side, because he also went for the two inboard engines, and he set both the inboard on the starboard and the one on the port side, but they both were on fire. And I heard later from the front gunner that he heard the gunners say he's fallen away, i.e. Perhaps some of our ammunition had got in, had hit the front of his aircraft and damaged him. But he could have just sort of tipped his wings up and slid away. I don't know whether he was for sure whether he was done for or not. But certainly we were going down. And the
So what, you'd suffered engine and wing damage?
Yes, well, yes, two engines, the inboard ones in particular.
Can I just ask you about two questions from your log report? It says there you made two runs over the target, first one with moderate flak, and the second one you got hit by heavy flak.
Did we?
That's not how you remember it now, though. Yeah, I mean,
I'm afraid the detail's gone. The detail there was gone. Whatever was written down there was what happened.
But it's just not how you... You don't remember that part of it now, so...
No, I mean, the... It wasn't the only time we'd made two runs, but we had to be sure it was Aachen in this case, because all the other places obviously weren't.
Now, so what? The engines were two engines on fire.
Yeah,
that was enough to bring you down, was it? And we couldn't fly. Oh,
well, there were petrol tanks nearby, and undoubtedly they would suffer from the fire, and. From looking at it through one of the windows, I thought not only was the was it petrol and what have you and oil on fire, but I thought some of the metal was burning, because I think there was quite a heat generated, and I think there was some magnesium in the alloy. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. That was what we understood at the time. I've never checked that out. I suppose one could have done, but certainly I got the impression that with the slipstream. That we were going down fast, and subsequently, when I met the rear gunner after he'd been released from being POW, he said that the airspeed indicator was virtually off the clock, so we could have been going down practically 300.
300?
Well, I think we couldn't fly. Yes, airspeed. Yes, we couldn't have flown anything like that in ordinary level flight. But the fact that we were heavy and were going at a fairly steep angle, I got impression from what he said. I couldn't say that it was that was true or not, but we lost height very quickly.
Now, what were you going to do? I mean, how do you bail out? Who decides? What happens in the air? What was it like in the aeroplane?
Well, we were of course, there was one chap was injured, and
that's the rear gunner.
The rear gunner, and the New Zealand chap, who was our wireless operator then, having replaced McDonald, he went back to see if he could help, but I gathered that he couldn't do much. Couldn't get the bloke out, and I had sent off the German recognition signals of the day in the hope of putting the fighter off from the very pistol up in the roof, but I expect he just laughed at that and proceeded to give us another few shots, so it had no effect, but it was obviously we were in trouble. So Eddie, the pilot, said everybody get ready to go out. So I passed his parachute up, which was a bit of a way from him. I passed it to the second pilot, Mead, and he gave it to Eddie. And by that time, he'd say, bail out, bail out. So I was there. I got my parachute on, and we practiced getting out of the aircraft. We practiced with the Wimpy, and we practiced with the Halifax, and we got it down to a very quick time. And I sort of lowered myself onto the edge of the hole, having sort of got rid of the hatch itself, with my back to the nose of the aircraft. And I just about got my bottom on there. And I was taking my feet off of the other side of the rim, so that they were dangling down. I got an almighty shove on the shoulders. So I didn't have to make up my mind or hang about. It gave me a push and I was gone. And I sort of went out. I don't know how I missed hitting my head on the back rim of the aircraft, but I certainly did. And I saw the plane go over.
Now you were bailed out from about 2,000 feet in your log book.
Possibly, yeah, that's about it, I should think. Mind you,
you'd never jumped before, had you?
No.
So, what was it like?
Say I saw the aircraft pass on. I was losing forward speed, and I think we'd slowed down quite a bit when we got down to a couple of thousand feet. So we weren't going out at such a dive. But I don't recall pulling the ripcord at all. You're supposed to count up to a certain number, whatever it is, and then pull the cord to get yourself away from the aircraft so the chute doesn't entangle with the tailplane. But I think I pulled it fairly quick. Anyhow, there was this almighty tug between the legs where the straps went, and on the shoulders too. And there I was, dangling. I got no sense of movement at all. You don't feel any wind, because you're drifting in the wind, the same as you chuck a stick into a stream. The stick goes with the flow, and I was going with the flow of the wind, so that you didn't feel a breeze at all. The wind was fairly calm, so I didn't sort of wave about much. And I thought, well, thank heaven that opened. And that's about the solid thought I had then, that the parachute had worked, which I thought, well, thank heaven for the people that who packed it. And I then started to look around. I'd lost sight of the aeroplane. I couldn't see it, even with the wings on fire. So I must have been more or less in the same position as I was when I came out of the aircraft, with the nose of the aircraft behind me, and I just couldn't swing around far enough to see it. And I gradually went down in, and it was so quiet. You can't imagine the difference between the noise of the engines roaring, voices on the intercom, and the noise of the cannon shell going through. It was so quiet. And looking down, I could see it was moonlight, of course. And looking down, then there was an infinite number of trees, and they looked just like little blue bubbles all over the place. I was just looking at the tops of them straight down, and I couldn't assess how far away they were. I got really no idea, and looked around again, and to my surprise, I was crashing through the branches of a tree, so I was lower than I anticipated. And when I came to a halt, I was left dangling. The problem was, how far up was I? And I heard some dogs barking, a couple of them. So I thought, right, well, I'm near habitation of some sort. And I better sort of see if I can get down. I couldn't. There's nothing I could touch with my feet, which was any help. So I undid the lock on the parachute harness, which lifted with a big button that you press, and I bashed the button, and the four straps who were joined to it sprang out, and I dropped. And if I dropped a foot, then that was as much as it was. It might even be only 6 inches. It was a great relief. I saw that the canopy, the parachute, was all over the tree. It was an apple tree, as a matter of fact, a big one, bigger than the ones I've got in the garden here. And so I tried to pull it down, and that only made more noise, breaking twigs and branches and what have you. And the dog started up again. So I thought, well, if the owner lets them out, or they are farm dogs and they're only in kennels, then it could be a bit dodgy. So I stopped that, and I thought, oh, damn it. And I left it hanging. And there was a hedge next to me, so I couldn't see beyond me. And I was obviously in an orchard with a hedge all round. So I went, it was sloping, so I went on down the slope, and I found a gap in the hedge, got into the field adjoining, and continued on down the hedge on the other side to where I landed. And then there was some more bushes and a steep slope. So I slid down the slope, and I was on in a lane on the road part of it. There was no pavements or walkways or anything. You just sort of slid down the embankment as you do in a lane onto the road. And that was going downhill too, to the right. So I don't know, instinct sort of worked, I suppose. I went downhill, say, going up. And within 200 yards, then there was a house, and it got hard standing from the side of the lane back to the front of the house, and on it was standing a group of people. And I looked over to my right, and there was the glow in the sky. So obviously I wasn't all that far from where the bombs had been going down.
Now, whereabouts were you? The airplane seems to have crashed near Maastricht.
Maastricht, yes, yes.
And were you near Maastricht as well? I can't judge the
distance. Yes, yes, in actual fact. I didn't know at the time. I didn't know whether I was in Germany or Holland or Belgium. So my immediate problem was this group of people and the fact there was so much light in the sky. So I marched past them. I sort of, as if I was a military man. I don't know whether that was any use of doing it or not. Anyhow, I indicated that I was in a bit of a hurry, and went, and that was the only house there. And the road then came to fork, and there was a track off to the left. Well, in that last few yards, I picked out the North Star. I thought, Christ, I'm going the wrong way. If I go this way, then there's the whole of the North Sea, or the Channel will get across. Or the other alternative is Norway or Sweden. Well, Norway was occupied, Denmark was occupied. This all flashed through, quick as anything. So I thought, I don't want to go that way at all. I want to go down south. I'm going north. I thought, I can't go back past all these people. So I took the track, the cart track, which went into the fields, as far as I could see, although the road was sunken quite a bit. So I started going up this track, and it was gradually, sides were beginning to diminish. So I thought, right, I'm going to come out into open country. That'll be all right. And then I can go past this house and whatever other buildings there are on the countryside without seeing anybody. And I then noticed little lights on the bank on the left-hand side. What on earth can that be? I must have been somewhat disorientated, I must admit, because I thought they got an underground place there or something. But anyhow, I went and had a look, and I got closer and closer until the twigs were only about, you know, a foot away from me. And I saw that they were insects which had got a light on them, glowworms. I sort of breathed a bit of a higher relief, and that was the first time I'd seen any. So I thought, oh well, that's all right then, but that's a first. Anyhow, I continued up with my cart track, and the sides of the of the banks gradually diminished, as they would in a triangle, and you can eventually a sort of sentence I sensed a movement of light breeze as my head came up, and I was then out in the open field at the top of the this cart track, and I looked around. I stopped, and I could see a crash right across the fields from me. I took it had to be the Halifax. There was no other sort of crash anywhere near that I could see when I looked round. And that sort of gave quite a glow, and I could hear the I could hear what I took to be the roar of the flames, and also the ammunition exploding from the munition racks. And there weren't any bombs because we'd already dropped them, but they were quite loud cracks, and that sort of rather glowed and reduced one's visibility to a certain extent, that sort of bright light, even though it's probably a mile away. But I looked across the fields there. I couldn't see the horizon. I got an impression there might be some trees there, a little black sort of line. And you sort of looked from along the ground, and you looked up, and the next thing I recall seeing was the stars. So when I sort of passed from the present, where I was, more or less almost into the future, I suppose. Sorry.
Go on.
I've never felt so lonely in all my life. It was this vast open space, which finished with the stars, which were millions of miles away. Anyhow, I got over it, and I thought, well, we'd better get off. If there's anybody around, as there might well be. So I turned to the left and started walking through the fields, and before long I came into a field full of cabbages, kale or something like that. I thought they were cabbages anyhow, and every step you took, of course, it rustled, even though they were in lines. And I didn't get very far. I heard something else rustling, so I stopped, and that stopped too. So then nothing happened, so I started off again. Only I was crouching down low to sort of merge in with the ground if possible. And I went probably half a dozen paces, and the other person started. What the devil's going on? Because I could hear what I thought was motorbikes in the road way up ahead, and I thought the old German sidecar combination with two soldiers on. I thought perhaps they're out looking to see if there's anybody from the crash. So I stopped again and crouched down, and other person stopped again. Well, I don't know. So I stayed kaput for quite a time. Eventually, he got up and he moved away, and he didn't come my direction. So when he was out of earshot, I then moved on. And I was then on my own again. So I pressed on. I hadn't got
You never found out who the person was.
Oh yes, I did.
Okay, sorry.
Didn't come until the end of the war. You can have it now if you like, or I'll keep it.
Whichever's best for you. Too.
Doesn't make any difference. No, all right. Yes, I didn't know at that time who it was, so I did find out eventually. But there's a way to go before then.
Okay.
And I came across some diggings and what have you, which looked as if at one time there'd been trenches, but they weren't. Well, as far as I could see, they were there, but they weren't vastly extensive. Whether there had been any First War trenches, World War trenches left there unfilled in, I don't know, but I skirted round them and eventually came into a lane. And I made my way down the lane and came to a junction of several roads and of this lane as well. And I fancy that on certainly on one corner there were buildings, which gave me to think that it was a village. And I didn't want to go in that way. And I what I wanted to do was go south. So I cut across the lane, and there was another entrance there, which presumably was to the farm. And I stopped and hit and sort of crouched behind a big log, which was just on the verge there. And there was nothing going on. There was just the sounds of the odd dog somewhere barking, and the normal night sounds. There's the odd bird, but otherwise it was all quiet. So I chose the road that I was going to go down. I had a bit of trouble with some barbed wire fencing, but I got to it. And I started going down this road, which ran almost due south. I'd got the map in my pocket somewhere, but there's no way I even could read it. The moonlight was it was there, but it wasn't sufficient for me to read with. And so I passed on, and then I saw a light coming towards me, and I was on quite a good paved road, and I thought, that's probably a bloke on a bike. So I dived into a shallow ditch on the side, and he came past with his light on the front, quite dim, but you could see it from the distance. And he swished past. He didn't see me laying there. I was more or less in the shadow, and the grey uniform sort of merged in with the light, with the lighter grey of the grass. And I thought, well, that could have been dodgy. So I went through into the field that was there, and for some long way, longish way it seemed, I walked parallel to the road, but on the through the fields, and occasionally having trouble with barbed wire. But in the end, I got fed up with the barbed wire, went back onto the road, went into a junction, road junction, and there were houses there. The road I was walking down was pretty well at right angles to this road where the houses were, and some of them looked as if they were damaged, as if they'd been bombed or they had suffered during the German invasion of Belgium and France. And so I thought, right, yeah, we'll turn right here, that will take me westerly, which is as good as south in many ways. So I did. I went along that road on the right hand side, ditch and a hedge on the right, and there appeared to be a tramway track on the other edge of the road, and then there was a bank and a bit of a hedge or something like that. So in the end I walked across, and it was so, there was a tramway track there. I came back to where I was walking on the road, and I encountered certainly another one cyclist, maybe two, I can't be sure. And I then thought, well, I've walked quite a way. It must be getting near dawn. I've got to find somewhere to hide out. Obviously, the road was used quite a bit. This would be still in the dark hours of the early mornings. And there could be lighted or semi-lit trams going along it. So I branched off. I saw some what I took to be allotments. Whether the Belgians have them or not, I don't know. But this is what it appeared like, beside extra gardens. And I went back into the centre of a field and then followed a footpath. And eventually I came to a hedge, went through it, and there was a flat field in front of me. And then there was a bank, quite steep, because it was the side of the hill that had been cut back. And they'd sliced it off, and you were left with a sort of semicircular side to the bank. And then there was a field at a high level, probably 16, 18 feet up. And there appeared to be a copse growing out of this cutting of the side of the hill. So I made my way into the copse. There were bushes there and trees. The trees weren't enormous, but they were quite well leafed, even at that time. And so I sort of sat down on the slope. I seem to remember putting my legs either side of one of the saplings there to stop me sliding down. And I went off to sleep. Eventually, it was cold. Night was cold. And I woke up, and it was daylight. And I looked around me, and I was in a very thin copse. There wasn't much cover, a little in the way of low bushes, rather thin. And in front of me was the flat field with a track running along it. And it ran through a hedge, and there was a farmhouse down on the right-hand side.